Chapter 22, April 2057. The formal invitation came from Wu to Charlie Marlowe, evidently on behalf of the Chinese government. A rare open gesture to Western scientists, though not so rare as it had once been. The Chinese were notoriously secretive about their space activities, and even the moon was big enough, generally, for them to stay hidden from all but the most carefully positioned spy satellites. Now, though, they were evidently up to something in the Sinus Medii, and drawn there, evidently, as it was the location of the Galaxius artifact. Nobody knew precisely what they were doing, but even the Chinese could hardly blockade such a sensitive area. In fact, they were, it seemed, actually working in sight of the lurker. And so necessarily in view of the other national and international teams drawn here since Blink Day. So maybe now they were going to the other extreme by actively inviting nations and institutions to come visit. Whatever, the invitation came, and Mel was sent up as the representative of her boss, who was too busy to go herself. This time, Charlie had growled, make the most of it. Whatever the political logic, Mel, for sure, wasn't about to lose the chance. The journey out was predictable, but predictably astonishing. A Skylon flight to orbit, the day's long ride to the moon aboard a Jones Inc. Moon-Earth shuttle, the docking at the Lunar Gateway. Mel spent some of the journey wondering what tweaks had needed to be made to the mission profiles of the various craft now that the post-blink moon was in a new orbit around the Earth. The descent in a scarily fragile lander. She blogged every detail for Jane, her daughter, who at least feigned interest in her replies. And she kept the in-jokes informed. Noel, Tasha's dad, said he thought going to the moon now was like going to Antarctica had been when he'd been young, a few generations after the Scott and Amundsen days. They had been sending for plumbers and builders rather than heroes. Maybe it felt extraordinary to Mel. Once down on the moon, she spent another day in a reception dome, getting used to the gravity, undergoing medical checks, and being fitted with a surface suit from an extensive store containing all sizes. Then, finally, Mel completed the very last leg of the journey, by rover, 20 kilometres from her landing area, to the Sinus Medii. And there, the long shadows stretching before her, Melissa Kapoor climbed out of the last of the chain of vehicles that had brought her here, and stood at last on the surface of the moon. The rover had delivered her to a small survival and supply station. It was a squat cylinder a couple of metres tall, maybe a dozen across, half buried in the dirt, surrounded by a jet-black solar cell blanket. There was a small emergency stash of air canisters, food packs, what looked like medical infusers, as well as power packs and radio transceivers. Even as she and her ride companion stood there, smart cables snaked down from the rover to plug into the energy blanket. This was evidently a multinational site. The survival station itself was adorned with the flags of many nations as well as the FIS. The American states, the British nations, the Russian, the Chinese, the green of the African Commonwealth. And the upper surface of the station was inlaid with a helpful compass rose. Distracting details. On the moon. She looked down at herself. Her pressure suit was brilliant high-vis orange, adorned with a gaudy cross of St. George, the flag of Federal England, on her left shoulder. As it was intended to do, the orange clearly stood out against the colour of the ground, dirt, which looked a little like beach sand, pocked, pitted, and scarred with footprints and tracks. Her own footprints, which, as everybody knew, would last a million years if they weren't overlaid in the next couple of minutes by the passage of more booted human feet or vehicle wheels, she took a hasty photography. Everybody did. When she looked away from her footprints, the dirt itself seemed bright under a pitch-black sky, more complex in texture than she had imagined, with hummocks, even individual grains, casting long shadows in the low sunlight. So much for the detail. Now, the big picture. She turned, trying to orient herself. Thanks to the compass rose, she could tell that it was off to the lunar northwest that she saw an object oddly like an artist's easel, a gaunt frame standing on three legs, and fixed to the frame, instruments and what looked like a decayed solar energy panel. She recognized it immediately. This was Surveyor 6, of course, the old American probe, and the first human artifact to land in this place, once the center of the visible face of the moon. She knew that the second craft to land here, the Americans' dedicated spy probe, had long since been removed. Not far from the Surveyor, though, was another puzzle, a patch of ground that glimmered oddly, almost like a lake of some blackish fluid, she thought, like crude oil. But no oil could flow here. A solar energy blanket, like the one near the survival station. It seemed to have a different, more organic texture. A single suited figure seemed to be standing guard over it. Then, turning slowly anti-clockwise, a little way away from the blanket, she saw a kind of fenced-off compound, maybe 50 meters across. A single dome-shaped habitat stood within the fence, and there were people, maybe a dozen of them, standing together in pairs or threes, or moving around with casual Buzz Aldrin moon hops. Human beings moving, working together, here on the surface of the moon. From a distance, these lunar workers looked similar, all encased in heavy-looking pressure suits, their visors gold as hers was. Upgrades in the suits from the old Apollo days were obvious, though, just as were featured on her own suit. Strong-looking hinges at the joints, a glimmer of exoskeletal support, copper-coloured frames around the limbs and back. She was too far away to make out any ID, or even national flags, though the suits were bright with non-lunar colours, red, electric blue, green, for ease of spotting. Some of her companions from the ride drifted over that way, some lugging gear from the rover. If these workers were speaking to each other, she wasn't being copied in. But she did glimpse what most of the people inside the barrier were working around. At the centre of the fenced-off area, she saw a low mound of dirt, shallow, sprawling, its summit rising maybe 2 metres from the base landscape, its contours softened by the ubiquitous dust. She recognised the morphology with a shock. She had come a hell of a long way, she thought, since she had had her first remote glimpse of this back in January at Tasha's flat. Now she was here. It was here. No more than 50 paces away from where she stood. It would have seemed unremarkable to her, had she happened on it. A bit of geology, probably, unusually symmetrical, not particularly out of place in this arid landscape of ancient volcanism and impact-processed dust. But now this mound was ringed by instruments, and patrolled by drones hovering overhead, presumably carefully positioned so their low-gravity rocket exhaust squirts caused no disturbance. The equipment of people from many nations, gathered here to this part of the moon, patiently working, studying. Unremarkable the mound might look, but that was why they were all here. This is all still very new. She turned. A lunar explorer stood beside her, in a chunky sky-blue pressure suit. She was tall, and Mel recognised the smiling face through the visor before she spotted the name tag on the chest, below a Chinese flag. Wu Yan said, "Sorry, I didn't mean to startle you." "Oh, no problem, Yan. Thank you for inviting me, us. Is it a month already since Hawaii?" "Indeed. Walk with me. I will show you what I can of the Chinese installation here. You are not the only non-national guest, but I will give you the private tour." Yan bounced away, an easy, expert bunny hop. Mel took a step forward, more clumsily. They set off, not for the alien mound, but towards that patch of reflective surface, the oil slick Mel had seen to the northwest. They might have been walking across a stretch of desert on Earth. "Your first time on the surface? Don't worry," Yan said, not unkindly. "You'll get used to it," Mel grunted. "If I get the chance. I only have a couple of days. But I would have grabbed this just for a couple of hours. The whole world is crowding here now, to the Sinus Medii, or trying to. But Charlie thought she needed a close-up view of her own, an impression. So your personal invitation was very welcome, and meanwhile my daughter Jane is either prouder than she's ever been of me, or more mortified. Sorry, I gabble when I feel out of my depth. No apology necessary. We all need distractions these days, I think. Not that home itself isn't a distracting enough sight, even from here." She pointed upward. "Take a moment. Look. They paused, leaned back a little, Mel breathing hard, and peered up at the earth. Once the home world would have been directly overhead from this point, now it was off-centre. Mel had never been here before. Still, that lack of symmetry was disturbing. Right now the earth itself was around 3/4 full, Mel estimated, and she could make out a scatter of city lights in the darkened crescent, looking like gathered up stars in that black slice of disk. It was early afternoon in England, as Mel knew well, having been in touch with Charlie Marlowe in Gateshead only a couple of hours ago. So the hemisphere she saw now was centred on the Atlantic, where a brilliant swirl of cloud obscured much of the familiar shapes of continents and ocean. She said softly, "A storm so big you can see it from the moon." "Storm Malacoda," Jan said, "named for one of Dante's demons, I believe. I fear it will be a long time before we give such storms any names but hellish ones. Christ, from here it's like Jupiter's red spot, plastered on the earth." "Well, you're an astronomer. You know that's an exaggeration, but that's how it must feel to be under a hypercane." Mel knew that this huge atmospheric disturbance was actually an indirect consequence of rock tides, induced by the moon's changing orbit around the earth, tides in the planet's very crust. Those stresses, building for weeks, had finally triggered a massive quake in the Atlantic seabed near Iceland, a major land slippage. That was a zone prone to instability anyhow, a place where continental plates were born from currents in the mantle that underlay Earth's crust. And because of that undersea slippage, a tremendous amount of heat, very localized, had been injected into the ocean and the air above. The resulting storm structure was thousands of kilometers across, and inflicted 1,000-kilometer-per-hour winds at its margins, as much as 3 times as strong as most major storms. It was so tall it threw water vapor clouds high into the stratosphere, which blocked out the sunlight and added to the ongoing disruption of the ozone layer by various volcanic events. The whole of both Atlantic coasts had been battered, locked down. People called it the first truly extreme event since the blink. "You mentioned your daughter," Jan murmured sympathetically. "She's safe, with friends in England. And she is safe too, I believe." "Yes, so he tells me. Busily working on the new Jones Inc. project, somewhere on the west coast of America, far from the Atlantic at least." "So," Jan said, "come, walk further with me, and let us talk of other things. Do you understand where you are? On the moon, I mean. The Sinus Medii, of course. Once the very centre of the visible face of the moon, as seen from Earth. But the moon has its own intrinsic geography," she pointed. "The nearest Apollo landing was Apollo 14, about 300 kilometres to the west. Now, a Smithsonian site." She turned. "The bright crater Copernicus is about 700 kilometres that way, roughly east-southeast." "Right, which is where the Chinese have their main base." Jan hesitated. "I wouldn't put it like that. This is the moon. Under space law, it is beyond the sovereignty of any nation. I would admit that there is a concentration of Chinese-owned facilities at Copernicus. But we may own the equipment we brought here without owning the land it stands on. Exploit the minerals we extract with authority permissions and the payment of suitable dues." Mel nodded, knowing this wasn't any kind of sophistry. "You're working within the outer space treaties." "Indeed. We need no permission to work here, within the law. We're under no obligation even to talk about it. But in these post-blink days, we believe it may be useful for you and the rest of the world to understand what we are doing here and why. We being the Chinese government, its space agencies and so on. This is why you and other witnesses are invited. We want you to see, not the detail so much, more the thinking behind it. For our work here is shaped by our global philosophies, and they are not identical to the West's. Perhaps you will have learned something of this from Xi. We are not explorers, you know. Not on the Earth, anyhow, not conquerors or exploiters, in that sense. Not by nature. To us, China is the centre of the world, and always has been. That is a foreigner's clichéd view of us, of course, but it carries some truth. A an ancient polity that saw off assaults by invaders from steppe nomads to the predatory British, even as we absorbed their ideologies and technologies, and they stole ours in turn. And in the last century, as the climate changes have come to dominate, and new ways of working and trading have evolved, so have we. For decades, the talk has been of a new Silk Road, a trading network spanning Eurasia and beyond, with China as the hub. We have rail links as far as Germany to the west, and it is under construction, or was before the blink, a rail tunnel planned under the Bering Strait to the Americas in the east, across Asia and beyond, gold, rare earths, agricultural and industrial products already flow along vast networks of transport links and pipelines. Perhaps you heard the slogans, peace, connections, co-prosperity, networks. You are hinting this is how China's response to Galaxias as a whole will be shaped. Some kind of mutual cooperation with the rest of humanity? Mel thought it over. What would Tash make of this? Why was she being told all this here? And cooperation with Galaxias itself, somehow? Is that why you are running these experiments in full view of the lurker? Yan smiled. That's very perceptive. Wait and see. Actually, we don't have a formulated strategy yet. I have learned that the Western view of China is largely a cliché. The inscrutable foreigner. Try to think of us as a nation, very smart, very rich, very old, and pursuing very advanced technological pathways in response to the extraordinary events of this year. And indeed, before. Much of it in plain view. I will tell you one thing we have learned. The one thing we do know is that we don't know enough. Not yet. She walked on, and Mel followed. They paused at the edge of the oil slick. The guard, in a sky-blue suit similar to Yan's, stood back, watching them calmly. That glimmering surface, black, gleamed with reflected sunlight, earth light. Mel saw that it was a roughly circular formation, spread so thinly over the lunar ground that she could make out the contours of hummocks and depressions in the dust beneath, even what looked like miniature craters. Small mounds of machinery stood around its edge, apparently inert. A framework of ladders and walkways had been set up over the slick itself, evidently for inspection or repair. So, Mel said, another solar energy plant? Indeed, more than that. Well, an experiment. Mel leaned to look closer. The technology is new to me. It looks like black foil? The way it's just draped across the ground, and very fine. Yes, it is not foil, much finer than that. Much finer than any energy capture blanket manufactured before. More exquisite. Okay, maybe 10-12 paces across, about that. It's about 100 square meters in area, at the moment. At the moment? An odd thing to say. And those walkways above it, for inspection? Indeed. This is an experimental facility. Inspection is constant, including by human eyes. Well, everything we do up here on the moon is experimental. The technology predates the blink, of course, though not this installation. Once we knew the significance of this location, we moved the experiment here. Tell me what else you see. Lean down. Take a look at the very edge. Mel found her suit was flexible enough just for her to kneel down. There was an authentic sensation of soft, loose, giving lunar dust under her knees. Bending, she thought she saw texture in the surface of the foil-like sheeting. Fine lines, almost like silvery wiring. And she saw a soft red glow, all around the rim of the foil sheet. It was hard to make out in the bright sunlight, but that periphery advanced, almost invisibly, imperceptibly, unless she looked away and back again, creeping out over the lunar dirt. It took a couple of minutes of watching before she was sure. That black sheet was growing, covering one lunar dust grain at a time. She stood up, startled, and would have lost her balance if Yan hadn't taken her arm. Tell me what you see, Yan said. A self-replicating solar panel. This is something of a test bed, but yes, that's the principle. This is a solar energy sail growing across the regolith, or out of it. The sheeting is essentially aluminium, Luna aluminium, very fine. Now, a sail this size can capture, let me figure it, 100 square metres, so the solar power input would be around 140 kilowatts, most of which we collect. This is a very efficient technology. Now, such a power level is capable of extracting perhaps 3 grams per second of aluminium from the lunar soil. The extracted metal is fed through a network of fine capillaries, almost like veins, to the rim. And so it grows. At its current size, it might grow in radius by perhaps 0.5 millimeter per minute. Like a fast-growing flower, the growth is just fast enough to see with the naked eye. But at such a rate, this experimental rig is capable of doubling in size in less than 3 days. And of course, the growth is exponential. The larger it gets, the quicker the aluminium is extracted, and the faster it grows, and the larger it gets. Mel looked around. Okay, you say this is just an experimental setup. Of course, you will have 50% downtime when the sun isn't above the horizon. But the poor battered moon still enjoys 14 days of sunshine at a time. And, more seriously, there's a lot more to making a solar energy panel than extruding aluminium from the lunar soil. You'd need heavy metals. Ah, but you have Copernicus. Yan just smiled. I am an astronomer, after all, Mel said. An impact crater, and a comparatively recent one. That is why the Chinese have gone to Copernicus. You have it. Heavy metals are rare on the moon, but we believe, maybe mined, from the remains of the asteroid impactors that lie buried under such craters as Copernicus. And yes, the younger the better. This is not yet industrial scale. For now, at least, we test the principles, the control technologies. We do see this as the basis of a long-term strategy, though. Such technologies as this, representing a massive extension of energy gathering and manufacture capabilities, and cheap, once the principles are established, will generate huge transformations on the moon and beyond, and enormous profits for the Chinese corporations holding the patents. Mel grinned. Which is why you are mounting this demonstration, here, where the action is right now on the moon. To impress the watching foreigners, and, I dare say, watching dignitaries back in Beijing. She glanced over at the mound, the unprepossessing centre of this place, all this activity. And I'm guessing it's no coincidence you are running this trial in full view of that, Yan said. All this predates the blink, but everything is different now. We have new motives. Yes, we move this rig here deliberately so that the lurker, hopefully, will observe. Mel thought that was a thrilling, disturbing thought. Whatever they were planning with this technology, the Chinese wanted this enigmatic visitor to witness it. She wondered what the long-term implications were of that, for the Chinese overall strategy, and maybe, she thought, for all their futures. Mel realised she herself was being used as a kind of conduit of contact here, in the face of the alien, between the two polar opposite rival cultures on Earth. She would have to discuss this with Charlie, she knew. Report it formally, even. As Wu Yan knew she would, of course. Come, Yan said. Let's walk over to the lurker. I know that's what you've really come to see. Her visit wasn't yet done. Still, Mel made out little she hadn't seen before. The mound of lunar dirt, the people, all contained inside a security fence that she was still on the wrong side of. At the fence gate stood another blue-suited guard, actually armed, with some kind of handgun at her waist. It was the first gun Tash had seen on the moon. Yan submitted to a retinal scan by a handheld scanner pressed against her faceplate. Mel was apparently signed in by Yan. But even she had to show a badge on her arm, lift her own sun visor to allow her eyes to be inspected. At last they were waved through, into the compound. It was a place of busy study, as Mel could immediately see from the activity within. Drones like small tractors rolling around, or hovering on squirts of rocket exhaust. People in suits like semi-deflated balloons bouncing over the scuffed ground. There were American workers, 3 or 4 in the score or so, active here. bearing on their arms the flags of the US or of the secessionist states. But most of those working here were of other nationalities, in this site that had not long ago been an American monopoly. Mel wondered what furious arguments, what uneasy political compromises lay behind the evident rough-and-ready governance of this place. The patrolling guards, all armed, all wore blue suits, and Chinese flags emblazoned on their chests. After the blink, the Chinese had evidently been the first to come here in force to take charge. Now the Chinese seemed intent on keeping the probe from harming any humans nearby, if it even could, and stopping harm coming to the probe from humans, and all the while keeping a boot on the neck of this extraordinary location. Yet they welcomed her, if perhaps grudgingly. But as Yan tactfully led her through the small crowd and towards the centre of the compound, Mel's awareness of the people around her, their gadgets and fences and instruments, the glares they targeted at each other and the guards, all of that faded away. Because here, at the centre of it all, was the alien. It wasn't much to look at. It didn't even take long to walk around, if you ignored the obstructive people in the way. Overall, at first glance, it certainly looked more like a bit of lunar geology than anything artificial. Just as she had seen in the first images, a flat-topped heap of regolith. A roughly conical mound, maybe 10 meters across, maybe 2 tall. But Mel knew what to look for from her briefings. A closer inspection had revealed surprises, including the very first anomalous observation seen all those decades ago in the retrieved surveyor images. For, from its land advantage, with its elevated camera, surveyor had glimpsed an opening in the top of the mound, an opening which, even in the crude photography of the time, showed a glint of ice. And that was a problem, Tash knew. Ice was suspected to exist on the moon in shadows and deep buried lodes, but any exposed to the surface vacuum and sunlight should have long sublimated away. Not only that, after reflections and highlights had been analysed by that second, dedicated probe, it was soon realised that the ice block within that mound was faceted, jewel-like, artificial or at least modified by artifice. Artifice that had become obvious in the aftermath of Blink Day, when a sphere of ice, apparently data-laden, had been fired into the lunar sky from this very location. Yan led Mel in a slow walk around the mound. There's still plenty of water ice in there. Or at least a layer of water ice laid over a kind of plinth of rock. A fine, perfectly circular plate, underlying the whole thing and covered by dust. We detected all this through non-intrusive scans. We took a sample from the plinth, just a few grains. But we haven't yet had the courage to take a sample from the water. Still, scans prove that the ice mass within is ice, water, down to the molecular level. Mel smiled. Once she said the Lurker's message missile was probably nothing but a fat snowball. In a sense, he may be right. Mel nodded. It makes a certain kind of sense. Charlie was quick to figure it out. There seemed to be water worlds at the strategic locations we have spotted, at Barnard's, Altair, and 55C. If Galaxius originated on a water world, it would naturally use water-based technology when it moved out into space. That much fits. And the logic of the Lurker strategy makes sense too. I mean, we looked for the alien remotely, through telescopes, optical, radio. But we also sent probes to the planets of our solar system, physical objects equipped to look for life directly, on the spot. And if you want to watch Earth, you couldn't find a better place to watch it from than the centre of the moon's Earth-facing hemisphere. As this place used to be anyhow. That snagged Mel's imagination again. Wow! She stared at the inert, silent mound. What if we could communicate with this thing? What kind of records might it have kept of our past? It could be a treasure trove, she sighed, thinking about that. But Lurker is a pretty pejorative label, isn't it? But perhaps appropriate, Yan said. When those old theories of Lurker probes were dreamed up, Not everybody was happy with the idea of a silent alien spy watching us evolve and reporting to its masters on our progress. And the fact that the name is being used now is an indication of how suspicious many of us still are. And, look over there. Now Mel saw, very near the mound itself, a new activity was beginning. A group wearing green vests over their pressure suits, the green of the African Commonwealth, was setting up a kind of screen close to the aperture, at the top of the mound, near the hidden icy lens. The workers were clumsy in their suits, but even before the screen was attached to the summit, Mel saw how it lit up with images. She glimpsed the whole Earth, and then a melange of oceans, landscapes, aerial shots, animals in the sea, forests on the land, people walking, waving, working, smiling. "They're trying to speak to it," Mel said, wondering. "I imagine this must all have some kind of international authorization." "Indeed," Yan said. "Well, on the face of it, isn't it a good idea? There are more structured experiments to come. You can imagine lists of prime numbers, various alphabets. Another old fantasy. How do you communicate with the alien, with mathematics? Well, now we can try. And I think the hope is that if Galaxius recognizes us as worthy, it will spare us. If not, answer back." Mel nodded. "It's not a pious hope. If the blink was intended as a message to us, then maybe we ought to try replying. Any way we can. We've had many applications for messaging of various kinds, beyond the scientific, I mean. From national governments, corporations, religious groups, individuals. There is pressure to let people through, but security is tight. We fear rogue states trying to message this thing for their own advantage, or corporations trying to access its technology, even to patent it, and the relevant law is very unclear. But most attempted communication is harmless enough, futile or not. However, we spoke earlier about China's strategy towards Galaxius. We do believe that one thing we should not try, at this point, is to challenge Galaxius."
"You mean like the Jones Inc. spacecraft project?" Mel said carefully.
"You oppose that, even though your own son is involved?"
"I can't stop him. Of course, he is driven by grief and anger, as much as by curiosity as by science. He lost somebody on Blink Day, as many others were lost and have been since. No wonder he wishes to strike back, which is why the Lurker is so heavily protected here." She smiled through her visor. "Now, you have spent rather a long time in that suit. Is there anything else you need to see before we take a break?"